All right, as noted up on the board, we are in our list of characters and symbols, and I want you to note with me that in the description of the beast, as found in verse 3 of the text, a woman sitting on a beast full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And we've talked about the 7 heads last week. You'll notice that as the Apostle John marveled about this woman and the beast that she wrote upon, we're told in verse 7 that the angel responded, "Why did you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns." And so in the latter part of the chapter, he gives an explanation beginning in verse 12 and going down through verse 14 of those 10 horns. Yes, Justin?
So last time we were talking about the 7 heads, the mountains, and the kings, and all that. And I was going to mention that I'd always taken verse 10 to be a parenthetical. So it never made sense to me for him to say the 7 heads are 7 mountains, and the 7 mountains are 7 kings. What do the mountains have to do with any of those guys? The 7 heads are just 7 kings. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's saying that the 7 heads are 7 mountains. And then he has a parenthetical, because he's talking about the beast. He says, hey, look, there are 7 kings. And the word there is translated different ways, right? Sometimes it says, and they are, and sometimes it says, and there are.
Okay.
And the "and there are" is what my mind is thinking about when I think about the parenthetical. So there are 7 kings, and 5 were, and 1 is, and 1 is going to be. And that's to set you up for the next verse. The beast is the 8th. And the beast comes from the 7th. Well, it doesn't make any sense if the kings are the mountains or the heads. The beast came from his 7th head. The beast is the 8th that comes from the 7th of his own head.
I got you. Okay.
And so it's saying the beast is related to the 7th king. The 7 heads are the 7 mountains. That's separate. And nothing to do with the 7 kings. Right?
Okay. Appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah. So what you're saying then is that the reference in the description of the beast to the 7 heads and 10 horns, that the 7 heads don't have anything to do with the 7 kings, but simply are from the 7 mountains, having reference to the 7 mountains. Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, again, that's just shows you those kinds of things and different insights that can come and different views that can be held in regard to it. So now let us talk about the 10 horns that are specifically stated as in verses 12 through 14 as being 10 kings. But they're described in a specific way. Notice if you'll begin reading in verse 12, going down through verse 14, that description. 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. And these have one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast, and they will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Now, the significance of this particular passage and these 10 horns has reference to the battle that is being wielded and fought against the Messiah, against the Lamb that is stated there in verse 14 of the text, and the victory. So what we're talking about in this particular section is really, if you want to go broad spectrum again with the broad theme of the book, we're referencing the victory that is assured, that is present with regard to this this battle between good and evil that we find in the book of Revelation. So what's the primary theme of Revelation? It is that, in fact, the good guys win, or Christ wins, God wins, and that is something that is important to be stated to those who are living at that particular time who are suffering their persecution. When you look at this great harlot, when you look at the scarlet beast, as we've gone down through the discussions in previous chapters, because, of course, the beast is a beast that was introduced earlier on in the text, we're talking about enemies of the cross that seem invincible. I mean, when you're in that situation, we might, again, make an allusion today. This is a little bit off the topic, but it serves to illustrate the point. One of the things that is argued with regard to the Second Amendment and the right of individuals to bear arms and to have guns, in effect, is that in the beginning of our nation, of course, there was an insurrection that was raised against the British. And how were the British defeated? Well, you had the men who had their guns, and they fought those battles. And the idea is a protection against government. Well, today, then we've got a, if we're going to use that as an argument, you've got the Second Amendment and say, okay, we have right to have guns in order to protect ourselves from the United States government. And, okay, well, they got bigger guns than we do, don't they? And so people kind of dismiss that. And so when we look at that, if we think about, okay, the United States, if this nation that has given us religious liberty, and we've had that for such a long time, what if there is a change in thinking? And it seems like that shift is actually present today, and it may get this place where we're persecuted for our faith. We're put to death for our faith. We're imprisoned for our faith. Our faith is no longer acceptable in this society. How can we fight against that? Well, wouldn't that be something if that powerful government were to turn its guns against us, turn its attention to us for the purpose of persecuting us, as was happening here in the first century? We might look at that and think, man, there's no way that we can stand up against that. We might would despair as a result of that, and how oppressive and how destructive and how minuscule our seeming ability to fight against it would be to us. And that's kind of the idea that I get with regard to the suffering that is going on here. And the saints crying out, how long will this continue? And the message of the book of Revelation is significant from beginning to end and consistent, that God wins and that you'll win. You notice when you look at verse 14 of the text, he's Lord of Lords, King of Kings, and those who are with him are called. And they're chosen and faithful. And these are the individuals who will ultimately gain the victory because their victory is with him and in him. And so the fait accompli that we've talked about a number of times, it's already happened. This statement that Babylon is fallen that we find at the beginning of this, Babylon is fallen. It's happened. That's found, actually that's in the next chapter. Notice verse 2. And that's that way be a way of alluding to this when we get into there. For my mind for a second, I've worked on chapter 18 this week to catch up. And you'll notice in verse 2, this other angel from heaven, he cries mightily with a loud voice, Babylon the Great is fallen. That's kind of past tense. It's happened. When in fact, it hadn't happened yet. But there's that audacity, that surety that is present there that this is going to happen. So much so that they speak of it as it already has. Isaiah the prophet prophesied the same way about the first Babylon, where King Nebuchadnezzar was king of that initial empire. And Isaiah spoke 150 years before it happened of the fall of Babylon, the actual Babylon, in the same exact way. And we'll talk about that when we get into the 18th chapter. But that's what we're talking about here, that surety, and they need to know these things. But this battle in verse 14, if you want another of the summary statements that give us this idea of what the book of Revelation is all about, verse 14 is a very good one to look at. So the kings, you'll notice, that are mentioned here in verse 12, they are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet. So kings without kingdoms. And there are a number of indications as to what this might intend. I think that in the text itself, the context itself, there is an indication of it. Kings without a kingdom, and yet they do have authority. Where do they get the authority from? They get the authority, we're told, from the beast, verse 12, latter part of verse 12. So how can you be a king without a kingdom but have authority? And one of the descriptions, or one of the explanations to be given, and we've already made an allusion to this with regard to the kings, the Herod line of Herods that were the kings of Judah, is the idea of a vassal king. And one of the things to keep in mind with regard to this, if you're, again, alluded to a late date and you've got this idea of a world empire, an empire that is great in extent, well, how did Rome reign? Rome reigned as a great empire with the emperor as being the authority, but also with the regents, the vassal kings throughout the different regions of the empire. such as the Herods. Herod the Great, of course, at the turn of the millennia. And then we got others that came in his stead. So those are the kinds of things. 7 decades of rule of the Herods. That's the example that I would give, and there are others as well. That may or may not be the idea, but you'll notice that the significance here is that these 10 kings receive authority for a period of time. 1 hour would be something that would be indicative of maybe a rather short period of time, or certainly not something that is extensive, but they have one mind. This is their one purpose. And that is, as a part of the beast, with the authority from the beast, is to wage war and to defeat the Lamb. That was why they existed. That was their purpose, the single purpose. So that would be strengthening the beast, serving the beast, destroying the enemy of the beast, which is Christ. And they are unsuccessful in doing that. So verse 14 states that very, very clearly. There's a text that I just wanted to read that is, again, I like to go with prose when I can to augment the symbolic or apocalyptic language that we're using here. Ephesians 1, you'll remember the statement made by the Apostle Paul in verse 20 concerning God raising Christ from the dead and seating him at the right hand in the heavenly places, far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this age, but also in that which is to come, putting all things under his feet, gave him head to be over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him who fills all in all. That idea of power, might, and dominion as residing in Jesus Christ is evidenced in the victory that is described here in verse 14 of the text. Okay? So, again, the significance with regard to this section is the part that these play in fighting against. And we'll be talking about that battle, the specific battle that we refer to as Battle of Armageddon in a later chapter. Questions, comments about those 10? Yes, Josh.
About the kings not having any kingdom yet. When I read that, and of course the hypotheticals can go for days. When I read that, though, I thought about, well, how in the world could one have the authority of a king and not have a kingdom? I got to think, well, you think about a Christian trying to talk about things across social media yet. I don't know why I said that, but you try to talk about anything across social media. What is sin? What things are sin? Who is your loving God and stuff like that? And if you catch the eye of the powers that be, as we like to say, you're gone. You're toast. You're eradicated from the internet. You can't do anything because these corporations have authority. They hate you. They hate everything that you are as a Christian because you actually stand for something. And they have the authority to eliminate you.
Yeah.
So I got to thinking about that. I got to think, well, is that just a modern thing? And then I got to think, as we're told in the old days, at the colonial times, the East India Trading Company, wow, they had a lot of authority in a lot of places. They weren't a kingdom, but they had a lot of authority in a lot of places. And whoever was heading that corporation had a lot of stuff. And then I got to thinking, well, were the corporations back in the Roman times? I don't really know, because I haven't studied that. But that's just a possibility of how you can be a king with authority and not have a king.
The 18th chapter, which we're getting into in a few moments, deals somewhat with that concept because it describes three groups of people. It describes the... let me get back. It's the merchants and the sailors, and for some reason the other one's just right now. And the kings, kings, merchants, and sailors. And we've already talked about the economic privation that was present. In other words, if they didn't wear the mark of the beast upon their forehead, then they were unable, or the mark of the beast. Wear the mark of the beast. It's a seal of God that's on the forehead. The mark of the beast. If they don't have that, then they're not able to buy and sell. and so they're excluded from. So there are powers that be. There is the false prophet that is the religious power that that influences the people, that causes the oppression as well. So that idea, that concept that you have there of powers and influences above and beyond simply a government or a kingship that likewise can be a cause of persecution, it's always been there. Yeah, I mean, if you're not in the in-group, you're excluded. If this exclusion is malevolent in any way, and typically exclusion is, as a result of that, you're going to suffer by being excluded. And part of that suffering can be like we are today. If you mention, again, let's say a Christian principle, especially one established from the Bible based upon social issues that the Facebook censors don't like, or some other, there's a big deal about that with regard to Twitter and Facebook and all, and what they've done as far as censoring some speech. We've got a lady that visits with us every once in a while. It's Marilyn Hultquist. That's Jill Hultquist's mother, Jill Blanton's mother. She was a member here for a long while, and Doug Hultquist, her husband, actually has been visiting with us recently. She's on Facebook, and she is outspoken on Facebook, and she's always coming up with these things, and she gets knocked off of Facebook for a week or two at a time, a bunch of different times, or her posts being taken down as a result of that, because she's very outspoken, and she caught their eyes, and now they're looking at everything she puts out just about, and it causes problems for her from time to time. She likes it, though. She enjoys the conflict, I think, a little bit. Anyway, so those kinds of things definitely are present. Now, with regard to these, the identify of these things and the conflict that is referred to, we really have covered the specific part, and we've had some good discussion and some different views that have been expressed with regard to the harlot, with regard to the beast, with regard to the seven kings, as well as the ten kings. The remainder of these things that are up on the board, starting with the purple and scarlet, all of these have references to certain things that describe either the beast or describe the harlot, and I don't want to spend a great deal of time on them because they're simply examples of the apocalyptic language, the metaphors and all that we've talked about. So what I'm going to do is go through them fairly rapidly so we can get into the 18th chapter. But if there is anything that remains unstated or anything you want to share about these that I do not as we go on, please just raise your hand or interrupt me and we'll stop. So let's start first of all with the purple and scarlet that are described as being what the woman is arrayed with in verse 4. So this harlot, mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth. That's what's written on her forehead in verse 5. She was dressed with purple and scarlet. So purple and scarlet is a reference, whenever you see this, to royalty or power, riches. It's something that these kinds of cloths, these colors, were not readily available in the first century. And I want you to remember that the synthetic dyes, I mean, when you look at our, y'all are dressed fairly conservatively here, but I see pink, purple, you got some guy in bright red in the back and a few others, and here I got my yellow. So we're pretty colorful compared to what it would have been in the first century. But if someone was wearing purple or scarlet, that was a sign that they had money or they had prestige in some way. And so wealth, social status, political power, this would be a part of the allurement of this woman. When you see her described in this particular text as a harlot and as a seducer, and you look at that phrase in verse 6, the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs. This is an evil woman. You think, boy, she's ugly. But that's now not how she is presented to the world. That's not the world thinks. The world looks at her and they see this beautiful woman, this appealing woman. Well, one of the reasons for that is what she's wearing. Just as an interesting point, purple dye was manufactured by the Phoenicians from a marine mollusk. And what they would do is they would break the shell to get access to a small gland that they removed, and then they crushed it. And what came out was a milky substance that when it hits the air, it basically becomes red or purple when it's exposed to air. And I was reading about this. This is from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, and they said that there are piles of these broken shells that still remain on the coast in Sidon and Tyre, and you can actually go and still see the evidence of what was being done. So this was the way, because they didn't have synthetic dyes or ability to manufacture in that regard. These were all natural dyes. That's the way they got the dye. Well, that's, you had to kill a lot of mollusks, crush a lot of shells to get a little bit of dye, and this is something only rich people and powerful people could afford. There are references that we could look at in that regard. For example, in 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 14, the veil in the Temple of Solomon between the holy place and the holiest of holies, it is described as blue, made of blue, purple, crimson, and fine linen with cherubim woven into it. So, again, that's a positive thing there. And again, this is positive in the sense of what she is wearing looks good. It looks important. It looks special. And this is something that makes her, again, more appealing to the kings as she seduces them. So the second one, you'll notice the scarlet. Scarlet and crimson probably refer to the same things. We already made reference to the veil that it was blue, purple, and crimson. So this is another very scarce dye. The way scarlet and crimson were obtained was through a bug. I don't know what the name of the bug. ISBE didn't say what the bug's name was or what kind of bug it was. But basically, you had to squash a lot of bugs to get crimson dye. And again, this is something that you had to be relatively expensive process and time-consuming and labor-intensive. There's a text in Daniel 5 in verse 16. This is Belshazzar. You'll remember who asked Daniel. Finally, he heard about Daniel, and he had this writing on the wall that was troubling him, and he wanted Daniel to tell him about it. And he said, "I've heard of you." This is 5:16. He said that you can give interpretations, explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing, make known to me its interpretation. You shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. So that's what he was offering. This is something that was, again, indicative of power and or riches. Okay, so that's with it, purple and scarlet. It's also the same thing with gold, stones, and pearls. I don't have any ISBE stuff to tell you how you get gold or how you get pearls, but it's the sign of alluring wealth. Precious jewelry that appeals to the worldly and sensual. And the same thing with the golden cup. Now, the golden cup is a little bit different. You notice in verse 4, woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, precious stones, and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So again, just kind of think of it this way. You're holding up a cup, and you're dressed in purple, arrayed as royalty. You've got precious stones about your face, and a gold cup. Now, that's something that is alluring. You don't look in a cup yet, but the gold cup is something that is especially alluring. But the significant aspect of that cup is what it was filled with. So this is a facade. This is an outward presentation that is not touching the reality of who this woman actually was and how despicable and evil and ugly that she was. So this is beauty that's skin deep in the very clearest definition of the term. What that reminds me, though, beautiful on the outside but filled with abomination and filth, is that it is almost identical to the language of Jesus in Matthew 23. You remember the woe pronounced to the Pharisees and the scribes. He said, "You cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of extortion and self-indulgence." He said, "First cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. You're like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside they are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you are outwardly righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." So that's represented by the cup that's full of abominations. Outwardly, this is a picture that she gives of royalty, of alluring attributes that seduces these kings to have fornication with her, but inwardly she's evil, she's despicable, she's ugly. So there is the difference, which is why God loves the gentle and quiet spirit, the inward beauty that comes from Christian women rather than that which is outward. All right, questions, comments about the accoutrements of the woman? Yes, Tommy.
I want to say real quick, this language would have been familiar to the Christians in the first century, and it should be familiar with us because this is how sin is always presented.
Yeah.
Satan has to make it look really pretty. I always say, you're not going to tempt me to do something with a bowl of spinach.
you can bowl ice cream, and then we can talk. It's always got something that will tempt you, something that is alluring. But in reality, death is the result.
Yeah. Good.
So that's one of the I mean, again, there's so many applications we can make all through this, but that's one of the important ones to make is the fact that sin is alluring. She is alluring, which is why she's able to seduce these individuals to engage in evil with her. Look at the description that is given, the full title of Head on the Harlot in verse 5. So you see this alluring figure that's there, but this is what's on her forehead. And I'm not sure if there's significance with regard to what's on her forehead so everybody can see it. If that's the case, the kings sure aren't looking at it. But it is that identification. No matter how she presents herself, this is what is actually the case. She is Babylon the Great. Babylon expressed as a negative thing, having reference to the evil of the first empire that Nebuchadnezzar was head of, as described in Daniel 2. She is the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So that's the title. This is what is indicated as the reality. And that is that the woman is ungodly, evil, corrupt, and she is a seducer of kings. The word mystery is an interesting one there. In verse 7, the angel said to me, "Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman." The word mystery there is something that is a word used from time to time in Scripture indicating that it is something that brings awe and amazement. In other words, wow, how can this be? This is the type of thing. But it's being revealed here in this particular text as to what it actually is. So this woman was looked at by the world with amazement and awe. And they were, again, seduced by her and her shallow beauty. But the reality was that she was a harlot. She was one who was sexually promiscuous. And again, we've talked about how harlotry and idolatry is something that is very much paralleled. I'm thinking ahead, so I probably misstated this. Let me restate it over again. That the idea of sexual promiscuity is something that is aligned with and used as a metaphor for idolatry and the worship of other gods. Let me give you one example. The sins of Israel that are described in Psalm 106, beginning in verse 35 and going through verse 39. If you want to write that down, Psalm 106, 35 through 39. Concerning the sins of Israel, notice how they're described. They mingled with the Gentiles and learned their works. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They sacrificed even their sons and daughters to demons and shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. Thus they were defiled by their own works and played the harlot with their own deeds. So you see that parallel. We've talked about that with regard to idolatry that was present among the Jews, idolatry that was certainly present in the pagan. One of the things that was kind of interesting to me when I did go over to the Bible lands that one time many years ago, went with Joni Von Staley, that we went to the ruins of Chorazin, which was on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee, and there was a synagogue there. And one of the stones of the synagogue, you've got just a few stones, you know, just kind of a half-destroyed building, and one of the, close to the foundation, one of the stones had the image of Medusa on it. A very clear image with the snakes radiating out of the head. And it was kind of an interesting thing that at whatever time this was destroyed, and the idea was the destruction, of course, of the temple in AD 70 and the destruction of all of those synagogues and such at that time, that there was already a pagan image that was found within a Jewish synagogue in the first century. And I thought that was a very interesting thing that was present at that time. So not surprising particularly with the evidence that we see in the Old Testament of Israel's idolatry, that these kinds of influences were there. But that's the idea that is found there. The seduction, interplay, the illicit nature of these kinds of things that is seen with regard to idolatry especially. So we identify Babylon the Great in her evil here in this place, what she is, in contrast to what she appears to be to those who are wooed by her seductive charms. All right? Questions, comments about the description that's given in verse 5? Babylon the Great. Okay, so we continue on then. In verse 6, he was drunk with the blood of the saints and martyrs. Again, an indication of the persecution even unto death that we've seen already in other parts of the book. But being drunk is something that indicates an obsessive thing. This was, and by the way, I think about this and I wonder. So we go into history and we see some acknowledgement of persecution. Persecution by the Jews early in the first century, persecution by Nero, though not extensive, but he certainly hated the Jews. And then Domitian, even during the time of Domitian, which is the time in which we would place the book being written if we take the late date, though it was a prevalent or an obvious aspect of the emperor's rule, we talked about it one time that it's not so much that they were singling out Christians because of their abhorrence of the Christian faith, but rather they were singling out Christians and others who would not worship the emperor. In other words, if you rejected emperor worship, you were in effect an atheist. You weren't believing in the God, and as such you were worthy of a persecution even to death. But when you look at it secularly, you come and you go and look at all of these things that we have concerning these persecutions and such, it's really not a big deal secularly. And I think about that too in our society today. There are many people today that consider Christianity in general. I mean, just in other words, we're talking about their view of Christianity, which is inclusive of all the denominations and all the error that is out there that God does not endorse. But that's a small segment of the world. Now, they'll talk about figures and acknowledge the fact that nominally there are a lot of people that call themselves Christians. But as a part of our society, you realize in the last four or five elections, an individual who believes in the creation account and who believes that miracles were performed in the first century, that they are said by many to be unfit to hold public office simply because they have those, quote, superstitions. The world dismisses us. And what I want you to note in regard to this is though the world dismisses us with regard to these things, God is saying this is the central conflict in the universe. This is it. And the world is dismissive because they see us as being a minor. When you take it with regard to the Lord's people and you talk about the evidence of the existence of the Lord's church of the ages, if you talk about churches of Christ today and the view that the world has, we're a small sect of Christendom in their way of thinking. If you talk about those who remain faithful in the institutional issues and further subdivide the churches of Christ from the institutional churches and the non-institutional churches, then it even gets more insignificant. We're a speck on the windshield. They don't pay attention to us at all, except to ridicule and maybe one day to oppress or to persecute. But this is the big conflict, and that's the way we look at it because that's the way God looks at it. This is big stuff here that we're referring to in this particular text. This woman is in opposition to God's people. This Roman Empire in trying to destroy God's kingdom is in the biggest conflict that there is. We fight against principalities and powers and the rulers of the darkness of this age. And so it's a big deal. It's just that the world doesn't recognize it as a big deal. That's why we need the inspiration of Scripture to reveal it to us. Okay, so that's my preaching for the purpose, and I just accidentally got out of my notes, too. That's one of the bad things about having electronic notes. If you hit the wrong button, then you get out of them completely. Okay, so now let us go on then to the bottomless pit. Now, the bottomless pit is something that has been identified by us already. We've seen mention of it in chapter 9. And verses 1 and 2 of chapter 9, with regard to the star falling from heaven, to him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit. In chapter 11, in verse 7, we read about that bottomless pit. They finished their testimony. The beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome, and kill them. And then I want you to notice ahead, just a little bit ahead, in chapter 20. Chapter 20 and verses 1 through 3. Chapter 20, verses 1 through 3. The angel came down from heaven, having a key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his head. He laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years are finished. And after these, he will be released for a little while. We'll talk a little bit about that as we get there. But this bottomless pit is the abode or habitation of Satan and his minions or his agents. And I want you to notice in the verse, chapter 17 and verse 8, when it talks about the beast that you saw was, is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit, he will go to perdition. So just as an object lesson with regard to this morality tale, what comes down from above, descends from above, the angels, the messengers of God, the voices, all of it, they're in control, they are powerful, ultimately they gain the victory. What comes or emanates from the bottomless pit, though they are powerful, and though they oppress and although they persecute, ultimately they go to perdition. They go to ruin. That's what the word perdition means. It talks about utter desolation or utter ruin. That's what the definition of the term is. And that is certainly the case with regard to the beast as indicated in this text. All right. Final three. We've got the Book of Life, which again has been stated time and again. We won't go through and read all of them, but do remind you in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 8 that the ones that will worship the beast are the ones whose names have not been written in the Book of Life. Revelation 3, 5, that he who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and his name will not be blotted out of the Book of Life. And then in Revelation chapter 20, at the great white throne judgment, we are told that in verse 15, anyone not found written in the Book of Life was cast into the lake of fire. So the Book of Life is the book that contains the names of those who are chosen by God and who are safe. Their abode will be eternity in heaven. You'll notice a couple of things about this. The ones who are not written in the Book of Life, they don't get to heaven. And it is possible to have your name blotted out of the Book of Life. And I think that's an interesting point. Is the ones who have their names blotted out, that is erased from or scribbled out, those are individuals who sacrifice their standing with God, which I think is an indirect example of what we might refer to as the possibility of apostasy or losing our faith. And then we've got the Lamb that is mentioned, which again is one that we know very well. The Lamb has reference to the Christ, several times identified as such. In chapter 5 and verse 6 and 7, in the midst of the throne, four living creatures, in the midst of the elders stood a Lamb as though it had been slain, having seven horns, seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent into the earth. He came and took the scroll out of the hand and was able to open the seals to the scroll and start this entire imagery and such that we've been talking about from the fifth chapter on. So that has reference to the Christ. And then finally, the waters. And the waters, again, are identified as peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And so the beast has this authority. The beast, just as the woman is sitting on the beast, having reference to the city, then we have the beast that is sitting upon the waters, again, having an indication or idea of dominion. Dominion or rule. And so this is, again, an indication of an empire that has authority and that has extent, multitudes, nations, tongues, peoples, as an indication of the breadth of its influence and breadth of its dominion. All right? So, yes, Justin.
I just want to point out this example of God using evil for good things, because the ten kings go to war with the Lamb. They also destroy the harlot.
Right.
So it's like when he has Babylon judge Assyria, or the Medo-Persians judge Babylon, or something like that. He's going to take these ten kings, and he's going to enact a judgment on the harlot also.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. I intended to talk about that last week, and I think it did make an allusion to it at least, but probably didn't get it out well. This idea here, too, to note, is that the influence of the woman is a seduction. Oftentimes those kinds of things turn sour. And someone say, well, these ten kings that are working with the authority of the beast, how all of a sudden now do they make the woman desolate? We're going to talk in chapter 18. There's an allusion to it in 17. In 18, we're going to actually talk about the fall of Babylon, the fall of the woman. And there can be easily, you think about this, their defeat and such, and how that they would utilize that, they become disenchanted, for example, with the seductive powers of the woman, and they would turn on her. How that often happens. There's an illustration of this in chapter 18, when you have this Babylon has fallen, you have the judgment coming upon Babylon, and what do the kings do? What do the merchants do? What do the sailors do? They stand far away and look with they look aghast at what's going on. But those who were her friends and her influencers, and those who were or influenced by her and were seeking to hold her up, boy, they fled the ship real quick when bad things began to happen to her, which you see often in history as well. But yeah, I appreciate that very much. That evil was used to destroy, and that's, I mean, you can even think of that with regard to the people of God. That Babylon, that captivity was ordained by God using the evil empire of Babylon, the evil empire of Assyria with regard to Israel, first of all, which led to the dissolution of the 10 northern tribes completely. So yeah, God does use even evil for his purposes. Questions, comments? We will get into chapter 18, and it's an interesting one. So be sure and read it and be ready for it. And what I'm wanting from you as we begin our time in chapter 18 together is your emotions or your initial insights, the perceptions that you have from a first reading of it. So kind of keep those things in mind, and then we'll get into a discussion of the chapter. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. Thank you.